Welcome to the SMA News Today podcast. I'm your host, Kevin Schaefer. I have SMA Type 2, and I am a columnist and forums director for SMANewsToday.com. Welcome to the SMA News Today podcast. I'm your host, Kevin Schaefer. And joining me today, we have a very special guest with us today. Garrett Lerner is one of the writers and executive producers of the new NBC drama, Ordinary Joe, which airs Monday nights on NBC. And it's a big deal in the SMA community right now because it features a character with SMA on the show who's also played by a disabled actor. So I'm very excited to talk with Garrett today. He is from Los Angeles, California, and he has his son, Zeke, with SMA Type 2. Garrett, thanks so much for joining us today.
So happy to be here.
Absolutely. I'm really enjoying the show so far, so we'll definitely get into a lot about that and just about your story. So before we get started, if everyone could please listen to a brief word from our sponsor.
This podcast was brought to you by Genentech, the makers of an FDA-approved treatment for SMA. To learn about our study results across different types of people with SMA, visit approvedforsma.com. That's approvedforsma.com.
All right. Well, Garrett, just to start off, can you tell listeners a little bit about yourself and just how you got into the world of writing for television?
Absolutely. My name is Garrett. Hello. I'm from Florida originally. Grew up there, went to undergrad there, and sometime during my University of Florida education, I decided that I wanted to be a filmmaker. It was the early 90s, and independent cinema was taking off. It was the sort of Reservoir Dogs, Clerks, was it El Mariachi? It was all these like really exciting time in movies, and I decided I wanted to do that. Got accepted into grad school at USC ended up going to the Peter Stark program for producing, came out to LA, and quickly learned by accident that television was much more exciting than movies for me, because the first job I got was writing a movie, and I spent a year and a half writing that movie, which never got made. And then my second job I got was writing a television pilot. And within 2 months, we had gone to North Carolina, where you're from, filmed it, made it, it existed. I was like, well, this is different and fast and furious. And some people I had gone to film school with had already gotten into television, and they said, you know, come join us over here. And suddenly the work you were doing was getting made, and then you were seeing it on television. It felt much more like a real job as opposed to the movie business, which at least in those days, the numbers were every studio would put out about 20 movies per year, but they would have 250 to 300 scripts per year that they would commission. So you knew just by the sheer numbers of it, there was over a 90% chance whatever you were working on was never going to be made. And that was no fun. And in television, you have to feed the beast. We need things on TV, so whatever you're working on is going to be made and is going to be seen. And I found the speed of it intoxicating and kind of never looked back. Got on the first TV show in 1999, I believe it was, and have been in TV ever since.
And that's a really fascinating time to get into it, because it's like friends and I have had this conversation multiple times about, you know, the modern golden age of television. And it really started at the seeds planted in the early 2000s with like Heroes and then Lost. And then now it's like, I mean, so many filmmakers have gone to television. And like you said too, about movie scripts that never get made, there was, I don't know if you saw like on Twitter, someone tweeted at like big name directors like Guillermo del Toro and Ryan Johnson and all these people and asked them like, how many scripts have you written that have never seen the light of day? And they had tons to talk about. And it's just wild that even names like that still have numerous projects that never see the light of day.
It's just the numbers of it. And when you learn the numbers, it's very sobering. But back to your earlier point about the golden age of television, when I was in my first job, which was a martial arts show called Martial Law, for CBS.
Nice.
Which was sort of a TV ripoff of Rush Hour.
I'm about to say the title sounds a little like in something in that vein.
Yeah. I mean, it was like a fun martial arts comedy. It was silly in a way, sure. But you know, that's where you cut your teeth and that's where you learn what to do. My showrunner on that show was Carlton Cuse, who went on to do Lost.
Oh, wow.
So like we were in good company, but that's what we were making back then. But that first year was the year The Sopranos came out. And it changed everything. It was sort of how like Nirvana changed everything in music. It was like The Sopranos changed everything. It was clear as it was happening. We would all come to work on Monday. That's all we would talk about for the whole morning up till lunch was like the previous night Sopranos, and none of us could believe what we were seeing. And you know, an anti-hero on television was just non-existent before then. And just the quality of it, the pacing of it, the elevated writing, directing, acting, you know, and everyone aspired to that. And then, you know, TV is now, it used to be kind of the ugly stepbrother to movies. And now it's just gone the exact opposite way. Like filmmakers used to like look down upon television. Now all the best filmmakers want to do television. They want their own limited series. They want to get in. Guillermo del Toro did television.
Right, right. Oh, that's good. And it's funny. I was just watching a video this morning that talked about Carlton Cuse. So that's really cool.
Yeah.
But that's awesome. And then thinking about like themes in your writing. So as I mentioned in the intro, you have a son with SMA. Prior to Ordinary Joe, did you ever incorporate this part of your life into your writing?
I have, not super successfully, in my own opinion. I did one episode of a show called Boston Public that I was working on. I wrote an episode about a high school, you know, it was set in the high schools, mostly about the teachers with some sort of smaller stories about the students. And I did a story about a type 3 student who's just first learning that he's type 3 and like going through the diagnosis process. I wasn't super happy with my own, it didn't come out as I had hoped. I blame only myself. I was less knowledgeable about type 3. I didn't quite yet know what story I wanted to tell, but I think Zeke had just recently been diagnosed. So I was going through, you know, I was eager to, you know, it's almost a form of therapy to put what you're going through in life down on the page. A lot of the reason we do this for a living. I then did another episode of the show House, which I worked on throughout, I guess, the late 2000s, aughts. And there was an episode where the main character had SMA type 2, but that was, you know, every episode of House has a patient, and the patient is always dying of something. It was a medical mystery. So the idea of the show was figuring out what the patient is dying from. SMA was irrelevant to what the patient was sick with.
Mm-hmm.
And what ended up happening in that episode is the illness ended up killing the patient, which had nothing to do with SMA, but I think the SMA community did not receive the episode very well. And I apologize for that.
Well, no, I think it's, like you said, it's a part of the journey. And like you said, you were writing more when your son was just diagnosed. So you were new to the community as well and to the whole journey that comes with SMA. So I think there is an evolution there that happens with storytelling, like from your perspective as a parent. And so I don't think it's necessarily something you need to apologize for, but it's something that like it represents where you were at that stage at the time. And like you said, it's a kind of therapy. And now you've come to experience things from a whole different perspective, seeing your son grow up. And I'm sure all of that is influenced, especially Ordinary Joe and many other things.
Yeah. And in the show House, I was dealing with big themes in that particular episode. I was dealing with big themes of like House's atheism. House was a notable atheist. And so it was kind of a philosophical argument between a believer and an atheist. And the character with SMA was the believer. And you know, we were pondering things like in the afterlife, are you still in a wheelchair, and things like things that were ultimately not very well received, that in retrospect, I understand why they weren't well received. But I was dealing with those themes before I had the idea to give the character SMA, and then I didn't foresee how it would land, not exactly in the best light.
Hey, it's all like I said. I don't know. There's an argument to be made about representation for, like, I mean, obviously you want the best representation out there, but especially at that time, there was no representation for us. And so even kind of like maybe misguided or like not like the best, or just still kind of learning kind of representation, it's still better than nothing. And then it kind of led to what you're doing today now. So yeah, it was a stepping stone, sounds like.
Definitely, very true. And it was a learning curve in, you know, neither of those earlier cases. Yeah. Did I cast it properly? That was also a learning curve on my end. I heard a disabled actor speaking at some point a handful of years ago about disabled representation, and how whenever a disabled role is cast and it's a non-disabled actor, how hurtful that is. Mm-hmm. And how, like, you know, to not even be up for or really considered for the role that actor was best qualified for. And it kind of landed with me, and I thought, you know, that it makes so much sense, and I'm going to change this for myself, at least going forward. I'm going to do everything in my power to cast proper representation.
Absolutely. Well, and that brings us to Ordinary Joe, which, again, I want to talk I have a lot of things to talk about here, but let's start first with kind of the background of the show and how you got involved. So the original pilot script for Ordinary Joe was written by filmmaker Matt Reeves over a decade ago. And not to be a huge fanboy right here, but Matt Reeves directed 2 Planet of the Apes movies and is doing the next Batman next year. So I was a little like, whoa, he's on this show when I saw the credits. But can you talk about how you and your writing producing partner, Russell Friend, became involved with the show?
Yeah, first let me talk a little bit about Matt, which I know this story from him. So when he wrote the pilot, and I think it was 2006, 2007, it was very personal to him. And he finished and he got a green light to make the pilot, which is what everyone wants who's making a pilot for television. And then he got a call from J.J. Abrams, who they're apparently friends. And J.J. said, I've got this movie, Cloverfield, and we need you to come direct. And Matt said, I can't. You know, I just got a green light on this television pilot. And J.J. said, forget the television pilot. You could do a big movie. This is going to change your life. And so, ironically, Matt found himself at an Ordinary Joe crossroads.
Wow.
Do I make this show that I love, that I just got a green light for, or do I take this incredible opportunity that I'm being handed by J.J. Abrams? And obviously he directed Cloverfield, and the Ordinary Joe script went into a drawer. And as you said, after Cloverfield, Matt's movie career took off and he did the Planet of the Apes, and he did it, and he just kind of never had time to come back to Ordinary Joe. So I think a little over a decade later, 2018, my writing partner Russell and I were around the way television works. There's very, very network television, at least, has very distinct seasons. Pilot season, you want to be selling your ideas to the network around 4th of July into September. So there's this little window. So right before 4th of July, Russell and I are always like, what do we have? What's our idea? What are we going to do? And this particular year in 2018, we didn't have an idea we were passionate about. So instead, we started to go to producers and studios and say, like, do you guys have anything? And everywhere we would go, they'd give us comic books or this book or that idea or remake this. And we had about 20 or so projects. And we went to 20th Century Fox studio, and they gave us like three ideas. And then as an afterthought almost, they were like, we also have this script Matt Reeves wrote, like, I think at that point it was 12 years earlier. And so Russell and I are dividing up the work. You know, we have to read all these books and get through all this stuff to see what we're passionate about. And I read Ordinary Joe and I just called Russ immediately. I was like, put everything else away. Like, this is it. It was so beautiful. The script was so stunning. The storytelling was so great. The concept, everything. And so we got a meeting with Matt. And he's such a generous, good guy. He's also great friends with Jason Kadams, who Russell and he's a bit of a mentor for Russ and I. We've worked with him on multiple shows. And Jason's like an artist who likes to bleed on the page. We call it bleed on the page, like just pour your soul onto the thing. And you could tell Matt was the same guy. And Matt said to us, look, this script, it was personal to me and what I was going through in 2006. But if you're going to come in, I want you to rewrite it and I want you to make it personal to you. And, you know, put your soul into it the way I did originally. And so following those marching orders, we did. And that immediately it was like, well, I have to write about Z. I mean, part of the story was a father son. So, you know, I had to filter my experience straight into it.
That is such a fascinating story, especially, I mean, yeah, again, I'm kind of fanboying out here. I'm not trying to go overboard, but that's amazing. That's how it happened with Cloverfield. And like you said, so for listeners who haven't watched the show yet, which I highly recommend you do, and I've written about it already, but the reason Garrett was saying that Matt Reeves kind of found it himself at an Ordinary Joe situation is that the show revolves around this guy named Joe who at his college graduation has three choices to make of what to do with the rest of the day. And unbeknownst to him, those three choices alternate, like drastically impact the rest of his life. And so the show follows him in all three of those timelines. So like in one, he marries his college girlfriend and they have a son with SMA together. Then in and he becomes a nurse in that timeline. In another, he becomes a rock star and marries a fellow graduate who he meets at graduation. And then in one, he's a single cop who follows in his late father's footsteps. So it's this great idea of like the choices we make in life and like what if situations and parallel universes of like, what if I did this instead? So like with Matt, that's so crazy that it's like that, you know, that it literally happened to him, but and then if it hadn't, you guys would not have gotten to the show and it would have been so it's that's yeah. So wild, but
yeah.
Oh, well, yeah.
And it's also similar, it gets a lot of references when people review the show and stuff to the movie Sliding Doors, mm-hmm. which is kind of known as the template for people who haven't seen the movie. It's like a 90s Miramax movie with Gwyneth Paltrow, and she's running for the subway, and you see in one world she just makes it onto the subway, and in the other world someone gets in her way and she just misses the subway, and then you watch both versions of her life, whether she made or missed the subway. And what we liked about Matt's script and why we wanted to get involved is it's such an exciting narrative structure. But on a deeper level, Sliding Doors is based on essentially coincidence, like somebody gets in your way or doesn't get in your way. Mm-hmm. And this speaks to self-determinism. This speaks to choice in life. You know, this speaks to how we shape our own paths. And I find that much more exciting to write about rather than coincidence.
Yeah.
Even though both are true, you know, we have discussions all the time in the writer's room about fate and about coincidence, you know, versus choice and self-determinism. And I think, you know, all of the things are true. Like you just said with Matt, it's a coincidence from my end that he got a call to go make Cloverfield. But on the other hand, it was self-determinism for me to make that phone call to Russ to say, put everything else down, we're doing this. And, you know, so yeah, somewhere in the middle, like we try also in the show to not give definitive answers to these questions, but just to ponder them. And, you know, we hope that people love the show for the hour that they're watching it, but then they hopefully continue to think about some of these questions when they're done watching it.
Absolutely. I think it was, there was a line in, I think it was last week's episode where, of like, oh, maybe we are just meant to be with one person or something like that, you know? Yeah. And it's that, and it doesn't give a definitive answer to that. It's more just kind of putting it out there. Like, are we, because the other thing is that all the supporting characters have a role in each of the timelines as well. So like, even if he's not married to Amy in one timeline, she's still in the other timelines, and they intersect and all these things. So it's fascinating. But well, we'll get more to this in just a minute. But if everyone could please listen to one more brief word from our sponsor.
This podcast is made possible by a sponsorship from Genentech. Are you living with SMA, or are you a caregiver for someone who is? A treatment has been FDA approved based on studies of different types of people living with SMA. Genentech extends a special thanks to all the individuals, families, and healthcare providers who participated in the studies that led to making this treatment option a reality. To learn more about this treatment, visit approvedforsma.com.
Okay, and so we've talked about this a little bit already, but one of the things I really love about the show is that it doesn't portray disability in a negative way. And Garrett, you had said, you know, that earlier on in your writing, when you had first approached disability, you kind of struggled with that, and you got some criticism. But now I think the response from the SMA community has been overwhelmingly positive in regards to Christopher, who's Joe's son. And of course he, well, I don't want to give spoilers away about his in the rest of the timeline, but that's sort of the main one there in the nurse timeline. And what I really, there's a couple things I really like is that A, he's portrayed as just an everyday kid. He has a social life. He has a family life. Like the disability is just a factor in his life. And there's one scene in particular in, I think it was a couple of weeks ago, when Joe is showing his mom how to do Christopher's care, and he runs her through like the Hoyer lift routine. And it, speaking as an adult with SMA, this was just so, I think, empowering and like very simple, but very nuanced, the way this scene was portrayed, because it wasn't made a big deal out of. It's like, okay, he uses a Hoyer lift to get in out of bed, like no big deal. And like, this is how you use it. And that's something that like so many of us, kids, adults in the SMA community, we do every day, and it's not a big deal, but to see it portrayed in that kind of way as just part of our everyday lives was really empowering, I think, for a lot of us. So huge compliment. If you got the criticism back in the day, I think you've got like, I want to commend you on that for making it much more authentic now. But I get, so going back to that a little more, like, how did you, what were the conversations with you and the writer's room about how to approach those scenes? Because obviously you're not scripting every single episode. There are going to be non-disabled writers working on the show. What was the process of working with your team and ensuring that the representation was accurate?
So we have, first of all, we have an amazing writer's room. There's 11 of us, and I love everybody in there. We all, as a group, meet together. We would do shifts from 10 a.m. to noon, and then again from 1:30 to 4 every single day. And we, as a group, would talk out every single scene. So everyone has their fingerprints all over every script. Then there'll be one writer of record once we've figured out what all the scenes are and how all the scenes will interplay with each other and all that. We do that as a group. But once it's all laid out, then one of our writers will leave the writer's room and go write that episode. But so I get to be present for like the scene you're talking about in particular is largely obviously from my life as a parent. It was definitely easier to get the parent part right for me to write, you know, Joe teaching his mom how to do that was something from my life. But also, you know, when we first got, we have an overhead lift for Zeke in our house. And, yeah. And of course, when we first got it, because we're a little bit of a goofy family, the first thing we all did was take turns getting into the sling. And, you know, partly to just experience what Zeke would be experiencing in there, and what does it feel like to be moved across the house in the lift, but you know, also because it's a little bit fun.
I should get my dad to do that sometime. We've had the lift for years, but I don't know if I've ever seen either. I think my mom has before, because she's had to show other people when I'm not here. Yeah. And so, but I don't think my dad's ever, so I need to suggest that.
You definitely get him in there. Definitely get him in there, and definitely take pictures of it. So you can have some blackmail material.
Yes, 100%. Yeah.
But that scene in particular, it was also, so it was there was humor in it, which is what we're talking about, is like Joe is in the sling and there's a certain amount of humor to that, but it's also very real and grounded. What was going on there was he wanted to take his wife for a surprise weekend away, and it was the first time they would have been away from their son. And that's also very personal and from my life, because like we as a family don't take vacations away from Zeke, because it's mm-hmm. it's just hard to, like, when do you make that break where you trust someone else to do the care needed? And so we like to try to present as much with humor as we can, but also very grounded and real. And so that's what was going on there. And then the writer takes the idea that we've described and goes off and writes the scene. And then I get to read it, you know, and make sure we feel good about it. And then we hired Shane Burkaw as a consultant to further put eyes. He reads every outline and every script. So Shane, for those who don't know, Shane Burkaw is a disability advocate, one half of Squirmy and Grubs on YouTube, and an author and a motivational speaker. He lives with SMA type 2 as well, and is just an amazing, amazing guy. And I first came across Shane's book, Laughing at My Nightmare, I want to say like 8 or so years ago. Mm-hmm. And it was so well written and so funny. And I just wrote him an email just to tell him how incredibly moving it was and how insightful it was, and how I almost felt like it helped me get to know my own son better. And then he was doing a motivational speaking engagement in San Francisco, which is not gigantically far away from Los Angeles. And I was like, I would love to come meet you. So I went up and had lunch with Shane, and sort of just became friends since then. And when I got this show greenlit to series, I thought, Shane can help me get this right, you know, which I've failed to do in the past. And B, he's a great writer in himself. So let's give him a bit of an opportunity to see how this whole world works of television writing and see if it's something he's interested in. So presenting, it's helping me, it's helping the show, and hopefully helping Shane as well.
Yeah, for listeners, I mean, I imagine most people who listen to the show know Shane, but I had him on the podcast a few years ago. It's harder to get in touch with him now because he's too famous and has a million things going on. But so, no, I when I saw that video, that was great. That, because I first heard about this show several months ago when they were casting calls going out in the SMA community and in MD Facebook groups and all that. Because like you talked about earlier, when you came to that realization of like, oh, it has to be a disabled actor playing a disabled character. And that was when I first heard about it. And I didn't really know anything about the premise of the show, but I just saw casting calls going out that they were looking for a kid of this age to play the character. And that alone intrigued me, because I was like, oh, wow, whoever's making this show is really committed to at least getting this part right. So that's great to hear.
I'll give kudos to the studio as well, because it was in our very first, you know, when you get a green light to make the thing, you then have a million meetings. And one of the first meetings was like a casting meeting, and what are we going to do? And we talked down each of the roles and what we're looking for. And as soon as we got to Christopher, I said, it's very important to me to cast this with proper representation. And I know it'll be hard and it'll take more money. And, you know, there are certain logistical systems in place for casting. You know, the casting agents are in LA and New York, and that's kind of it. And that, the beautiful thing is now everyone has an iPhone and they can make a tape of themselves and, you know, and send it in, pop an email. It's like the easiest thing in the world. So our reach was just expanded by technology. And to the studio's credit, as soon as I said it, they said, we'll do whatever we can to help you get this right. And they did. And they helped us get the word out and supported it from the beginning. So, and helped us unearth this magical being named John Gluck.
I was about to say, that kid, I mean, talk about ability to act and sing, because like we didn't get a taste of his singing ability until I think it was about last week's episode when he does the audition for the school play. And I'm like, dang, yeah. This guy's like rivals, you know, and James Wilk has a really good voice too. I think he's a phenomenal actor, and I'm grateful that the show discovered him, but yeah.
So are we. We're very grateful. Also, the singing ability, because in one of the timelines, Joe ends up being a musician. It just was like a magical father-son connection to have the son also be blessed in that way.
Yeah. That's awesome. Well, Garrett, another thing I like to ask guests on this show is just about their daily lives. So I've had a lot of, you know, parents and adults with SMA on the show. So can you talk a little bit about just what a typical day looks like for you from your working? And this can include how the pandemic's affected it, but both your work life and your family life, just to give listeners a little inside glimpse into that.
Sure. Every day, I mean, these days running a show is all consuming. And yet every day still begins and ends with family life because, you know, Zeke's 21, but he still lives at home. Mm-hmm. And so my wife and I do the care. And so getting him up in the morning is the beginning of every day. Getting him ready for, he's in an incredible program that he just got into out here in LA called Exceptional Minds, which is kind of like a vocational school that teaches animation and VFX.
Oh, wow.
It's like a 3-year program and he just got into it. So that's super exciting for him and for us. And we begin the day getting him ready for that. And then my wife drives him. And as soon as she's gone, I'm into whatever it takes to run a show. And on a day-to-day basis, that means putting my brain in about 5 or 6 different episodes at the same time, which may be, I may be guiding the outline of an episode, doing a rewrite of a different episode, keeping my eyes on set of the third episode that's filming right now, beginning to edit a 4th episode, and, you know, doing a sound mix on the one that is going to be on TV 3 days from now. And so you just kind of try and shift gears, meeting to meeting to meeting, like which episode is it? It's much like the timelines, like how do I keep this straight? Which Jenny is this, which Amy is this, but I'm doing it across 6 episodes at once. And like, wait, which story is this? Have they had that fight yet? Have they made up yet? And so my days are split that way. It's just kind of keeping an eye on all aspects of writing, filming, and editing.
That's great. It's funny. I was going to say, as a viewer, I have to like really pay attention to just because like it's easy to tell which Joe is in each timeline because he's got different facial hair and like and physique and all this stuff. But remembering his relationship to each of the supporting characters in each of those, it's like, okay, Jenny doesn't like him in this one. He's married to her in this one. And then like, and then even another character, like his best friend, Charlie, or then Bobby Diaz, the politician, like all these, I mean, I love it because it's, it makes you work a little bit and it's, I think a really engrossing experience, but I can imagine it's a whole other layer when you're the writer producer.
Yeah.
Trying to keep all of that great.
It's very hard for the actors as well, because they may be filming, like you were just saying, like Joe might be married to Jenny in one scene and barely knows her in the next scene, but we might be filming those scenes back to back. on the same
day. Right.
And so like they're playing that they're in love and married, and then they go change their clothes and come back, and then they're supposed to like, wait, we don't even know each other now. And so we send our writers, we film in Atlanta, and we send our writers to go supervise and be there to remind. We have great directors as well, and everybody's hopefully also that we're calling out what world we're in before we start rolling camera. And we have kind of a color palette that tries to help remind, you know, audiences, in addition to our own people, what world we're in, the music world, everything sort of red and yellow and bright primary colors. And the nurse world, everything has like a little bit of a greenish, brownish, kind of like home, nature, you know, fall colors. And in the cop world, everything has like a bit of a blue, black, gunmetal gray, you know, cop world tone right. to it.
That's the thing, the aesthetic is so important in each of the timelines. So that's great.
And yeah.
It's funny you're saying Zeke got into that, the animation program, because we were just talking right before recording that your daughter just got into film school as well. So it sounds like you've got several proteges.
I do. It's very exciting. I mean, it's a great, fun living, and I'm lucky to be doing it. And I came out from Florida and didn't know anybody and got lucky and managed to carve out this great life. And I'm so happy for them that they grew up here, and it's much more natural. It's a great industry. If you, you know, grew up in Detroit in a certain time in this country, you would be in the car industry. And if you grew up, you know, in West Virginia, you might be in the coal industry or whatever. You know, there's a lot of like regional factors, and they happen to grow up because I'm here in this industry that I think is a great industry, and encourage them. You know, it was shocking to my parents when I said I wanted to do this and move to California. It's not so shocking for them to want to do this.
I would say, I think it's paid off well now, but yeah.
That's great. Yes, we had a lot of good fortune, especially thanks to a show called House, which kind of turned everything around.
Sure. Well, Gary, this has been just a fantastic conversation. Thank you so much for coming on today. But closing out here, as a parent to a disabled son and as a screenwriter, what's something you want people in your industry to better understand about disability?
I think that's a great, I think that representation matters. There was something that I saw, I think it was on Twitter, and it was a mom of a disabled son just took a picture of her son in his wheelchair, and it included, I think they were at Target, and don't mean to be shouting out Target, but that is what it is. And they had like a certain section of clothing, and above this section of clothing, it was a photo of, you know, two models in the clothing, and one of which was in a wheelchair. And the son was, the photo was like of the son, just, you could see how much that mattered. And, you know, I think as storytellers, we're trying to put experiences on the screen. We're trying to put all range of experiences in front of people and give people something to relate to. And I think it's important to, and it's not just for disability, it's just for, you know, all range of human experience. Like, people deserve to see their stories told. And so, you know, I'm all for inclusion across, you know, everything. Disability happens to be one of my frames of reference because of Zeke. But, you know, like I shouted out our 11 great writers before, and they have a wide range of experiences. And I encourage, the way Matt Reeves encouraged us, I turn that and encourage them to bleed on the page, is what we always call it. You know, do the same thing. Like, whatever your experience is, and we hired a very diverse group on purpose to bring a wide range of experiences, and we try to cast a wide range of actors, and we just try to, you know, hold up a mirror to the world, and everyone deserves to see themselves, and deserves to see themselves presented respectfully and, you know, with great stories told for each of those characters, not just like the character who comes in and tells a joke or whatever, you know, like what are the human experiences for every character that you spend time, you know, I guess if I'm speaking to storytellers, every character you put on screen should have their own story.
Yeah.
And try and find your way to squeeze in that character's story, even in a limited amount of time. In our case, it's 42 minutes and 19 seconds.
And even if you condense it, even if it's, you're looking at the individual stories and like if you look at just how much screen time the nurse timeline takes up, it's only a fraction of that, but you right. still get, I was going to say, well, last week's episode did a really great job exploring the best friend, Charlie, Joe's best friend, and like his bisexuality. And that was extremely well written. And so it is this just like really diverse group of storytellers and characters on screen. Yeah.
Yes, thank you. And that was written by Abdi Nazemian, who's a fantastic writer. And that was him bleeding on the page. And mm-hmm. And our show getting far enough along that we are able to turn the spotlight here and there and there. And you know, it has to focus on Joe in the first few episodes so everyone can get their bearings. But as the show continues, we can start moving that spotlight around.
Sure, sure. Well, yeah, I just want to say it's a fantastic show. I highly recommend viewers, listeners to go check it out if you haven't already. But is there, so obviously Garrett, people can watch the show, but is there anywhere else people can find you if they want to learn more about your work or just reach out?
Shoot, I don't know. I guess you can Google me.
or social media or anything. Yeah.
Oh, I'm at Garrett Lerner. Twitter is my at Garrett Lerner. I think Instagram's the same. I don't really do much on there. But yeah. I was excited to get verified on Twitter for this one. So that's where you find me, at Garrett Lerner. And I also want to, depending on when this episode comes out, I'm sorry, when your podcast episode comes out, mention the next episode 7, which airs in 3 days. I just watched for the final sound mix and it's our best one yet. And so I encourage people to get caught up. Binge on Hulu, binge on Peacock, whatever you have to do, get caught up, because episode 7 is it's written and directed by this incredible filmmaker, Peter Hedges, who wrote What's Eating Gilbert Grape and got nominated for an Oscar for About a Boy. And it was incredible to just have him be part of our team. And he wrote an episode that is going to knock your socks off.
I can't wait to watch this. The podcast will probably come out after that, but regardless, if you haven't watched the show, definitely catch up on Hulu on demand. You know, it's all out there. It's bingeable now. We're 6 episodes in now, a few more by the time this comes out. So that's great.
But, perfect.
Yeah.
And thank you for doing this. I really appreciate it.
Oh, Garrett, thank you so much for coming on. This has been fantastic. And this is a joy for me because I get to really merge my interests together. We could talk about pop culture and TV all day. So this is to do that and disability. It's a reward for me.
Perfect.
Well, for our listeners out there, you can hear more stories and conversations like this by subscribing to the SMA News Today podcast, wherever you get your podcast. You can also connect with us directly on our forums and follow our main website at smanewstoday.com. for the latest SMA news and perspectives. I'm your host, Kevin Schaefer. Thanks for listening, and we will see you all next time. Take care.
The information in our flash briefings and podcasts are provided for informational and educational purposes only. Be sure to tune in daily to SMA News Today for the latest news and perspectives regarding the disease. Discover more content that might be of interest to you at www.smanewstoday.com, and be sure to follow us on social media and join our SMA News Today forums, a trusted SMA community ready to welcome you anytime.